This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We begin with the death of coral with NOAA scientist Derek Manzello. Then Dr. Eric Pino on social ecology and the dangerous metabolism of capitalism.
Most of what we think about coral bleaching may be wrong. New research shows white coral is not necessarily dead yet, and corals may not be killed directly by excess heat. Since around 25% of ocean species depend on these reefs, we better get this right before coral disappears from this blue planet. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has a coral reef watch program. Overseeing that is marine biologist Dr. Derek Manzello. He is co-author of a recent paper with a bleak outlook for coral. Derek Manzello, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
For starters, myself and a few million other people thought coral bleached white was dead. No?
No. So coral is actually an animal. It's a very simple animal. It's only about four cellular layers thick. But it lives in a symbiosis with a type of algae that lives in its tissues. So those algae provide much of the color of the coral. And they're also providing upwards of about 95% of the nutritional requirements for that coral. However, the symbiosis between the algae and the coral is very sensitive to elevated temperature. So once conditions get too hot, the algae start producing free oxygen radicals and other oxygen-free radicals that damage the tissues, and that causes the coral to expel the algae, turning them white. But again, when a coral is bleached, it is not dead yet. Coral can still recover from a bleaching event if the stress or the temperature declines quickly enough, but they oftentimes will have lasting impacts from a bleaching event. For instance, a coral that bleaches and recovers will normally show depressed growth and calcification for about 2 to 4 years. Its reproductive output will decline for about 5 years, and it will become highly susceptible to disease for 1 to 2 years. And that's especially pertinent in the Caribbean Sea, where there's many, many different types of diseases impacting corals. So bleached coral is not necessarily a dead coral. It is a coral that is undergoing a very, very serious stress event. And it's essentially starving to death unless that stress is removed and its algae can repopulate its tissues.
So talk to us about some of the great coral bleaching events in the last few decades, and is there a pattern there?
So the first mass coral bleaching event due to elevated temperatures occurred during the 1982-1983 El Niño event. And this impacted coral reefs throughout the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. So Panama, Costa Rica, Colombia, and the Galapagos Islands. Now, before this event, coral bleaching had been well known as a stress response in corals. So corals will bleach if you hit them with fresh water. They'll bleach if they're exposed to air too long. Corals will bleach if they're covered in sediment, if they experience too high light conditions. And it was well known that corals are sensitive to temperature deviations, but, you know, in 1982-83, this was the first time large-scale coral bleaching had been documented ever on the planet. You know, bleaching events had occurred before, but they were always very, very localized and always very much due to a proximate causal factor. So, you know, a great example, I think the first documented quote-unquote mass bleaching event took place in Jamaica in the early 1960s. So there was a severe hurricane. It dumped tons of fresh water into Discovery Bay, Jamaica. That fresh water washed all over the reef, bleached the reef completely. But that reef actually completely recovered from that event. So that just shows that corals are pretty well adapted to deal with stress that they normally experience and that they have normally experienced over their evolutionary history. Now, what we're seeing now is completely unprecedented in any record in terms of corals bleaching from high temperature. And when the first observations were made in the eastern Pacific in 1982-83, it wasn't immediately obvious that this was a high-temperature event because, you know, it never happened before. There was no precedent for that. And it really took another 5 to 6, 7 years before they really identified the smoking gun with lab experiments showing that, yes, indeed, high temperature alone could explain the bleaching across the eastern Pacific and the very high levels of mortality. So 40 years ago was the first time we really started seeing the canaries in the coal mine start dying. And since then, bleaching events have only increased in severity and frequency and magnitude of thermal stress. So 1998 was the first time on planet Earth we observed a global coral bleaching event. And during that event, it's estimated that about 20% of the world's coral reefs experienced bleaching level heat stress within a 365-day period. The second global coral bleaching event took place in 2010, and in that event, about 35% of the world's coral reefs experienced bleaching level heat stress over a year. Now, the third global coral bleaching event took place over 3 years, and this happened from 2014 to 2017. Again, we saw an increase once again in terms of the percentage of reef areas that were impacted. During that event, it peaked out at about 56.1% of the world's reef area was impacted over a 365-day window. Now, we are currently in the midst of the fourth global coral bleaching event, and this event is now breaking the records that were set by the third global coral bleaching event. So we are currently sitting at 63% of the world's coral reef area has experienced bleaching level heat stress in the last 365 days. So that's getting pretty close to about two-thirds of the world's coral reefs have experienced enough heat in the last year to cause bleaching. Again, the bleaching problem is becoming more and more severe and you know, a clear and present danger, like every single year. You know, this is an increasing problem for coral reefs that's only getting worse and worse and worse every year. And, you know, what we're seeing now is exactly what scientists have been predicting was going to happen for more than 25 years. So, unfortunately, we are now living in the world where we're watching these projections for the future of coral reefs play out before our very eyes.
And so many environmental records are literally off the charts. People have to add new things to the X or Y axis. You had to add a new level of coral stress measurement?
Yes, that's 100% correct. So at Coral Reef Watch, to simplify our bleaching prediction algorithm, our senior scientist, Dr. Gong Liu, developed a product called the Bleaching Alert Area Index. So this basically simplifies down the heat stress metric into very simple categories. So at an alert level one, that's when we expect mass bleaching to start in a particular location. And at an alert level two, that's when we expect bleaching to become severe and for mortality to start occurring, especially in the heat-sensitive corals. Now, last year in the wider Caribbean, by about the end of October, the entire region was just a blanket of alert level two conditions. And the issue was it was not showing just how hot and severe the heat stress had gotten. And the reason I say that is we were seeing heat stress levels that were 2 to 3 times higher than had ever occurred before, and 2 to 3 times higher than kind of that upper limit of the alert level two. So we went in and we had to add in 3 additional alert levels to reflect the new reality that we're living in terms of, you know, these marine heat wave events have gotten so severe that we needed to add in these new levels. And these levels basically were parameterized based on what has happened to coral reefs during past global bleaching events. So our alert level 5 is analogous to a category 5 hurricane or cyclone. And the reason I say that is because an alert level 5 is really when we can start expecting catastrophic impacts to hit a reef. So an alert level 5 condition is 5 times the amount of heat stress that we know begins to bleach coral reefs on a large scale. So an alert level 1 is when we expect mass coral bleaching, and an alert level 5 is 5 times that amount of heat stress. So there's been 4 events on planet Earth that have been documented where reefs around the world have experienced those alert level 5 conditions. This occurred in the Galapagos Islands in 1983, and then 2 times in Kiribati in the Equatorial Pacific, and then once in Jarvis Island. And in those 4 cases, coral mortality ranged from 89 to 99%. So at our alert level 5 condition, we estimate that a reef is at risk of losing upwards of 80% of its corals. So taking a step back, alert level 4, we estimate that a reef is at risk of losing more than half of its corals if you hit an alert level 4 condition. So last year in the wider Caribbean Sea, pretty much the entirety of the wider Caribbean experienced at least alert level 4 conditions in some locations within the Florida Keys, and some locations around Jamaica and the Cayman Islands did experience alert level 5 conditions. And this was record-setting, as you said, off the charts. never seen this level of heat stress in any record for the Caribbean Sea. You know, it was basically prior to last year, the amount of heat stress that we saw in the wider Caribbean, you know, it never really, the highest it ever gotten before was maybe an alert level 3. And that was generally isolated to a specific location around the Virgin Islands. Whereas last year, the entirety of the wider Caribbean Sea in Florida was at least an alert level 4, and many regions experienced alert level 5. So, again, we are living in a new world, essentially, right now, that appears to have started within the last year in terms of the oceans are just so much hotter than average. The heat anomalies are just so great. They're far in excess of anything that anyone's predicted, and they're really presenting a existential crisis for the existence of coral reefs as we know them.
And I just want to get back to that very frightening incident in the Galapagos Islands. I mean, these are supposed to be our marine sanctuary and our species sanctuary, and yet you said in that first noticed bleaching event in 82-83, it drove coral mortality almost to 99%. Is there still coral around the Galapagos, and why didn't it recover?
So that's a really, really great question. The Galapagos Islands is a very marginal environment for coral reefs. So prior to the 1970s, the scientific community didn't realize there were even coral reefs in the Galapagos Islands. So even Charles Darwin commented on the absence of coral reefs from the Eastern Pacific and the Galapagos. But in the early 1970s, a gentleman by the name of Jerry Wellington was working with the Peace Corps, and he started seeing corals around and documenting these buildups of corals. And he got in touch with his friend, a man by the name of Dr. Peter Glenn, who ended up being my PhD advisor. And they went out and they documented all these very modest coral reef buildups within the southern Galapagos Islands. Well, ironically, their publication telling the world, yes, there are coral reefs in the Galapagos Islands, was published in 1983. And in 1983, 95 to 99% of all the corals in the Galapagos Islands died as a result of that heat stress event. Now, the heat stress was so severe that the Galapagos presents a very, very unique example. And the reason I say that is because the Galapagos is the only place on planet Earth that we know of where the entire coral reef framework was completely eroded away and lost within about 10 years' time. So normally when we hear people say loss of coral reefs, what they're talking about is just the death of live corals, and then what you're left with is kind of that dead reef framework, you know, that's still providing some structure. So the Galapagos is absolutely the worst case scenario you can ever expect to happen to a coral reef because it was a complete essential loss of the entire ecosystem. And the reason that happened is really twofold. So first and foremost, the Galapagos experienced such high heat stress for so long that basically all the corals just died, right? And the second reason that the resilience has been so poor in the Galapagos is that the Galapagos is naturally exposed to low pH waters. So the waters around the Galapagos are naturally enriched in carbon dioxide. And the reason this happens is this process called upwelling. So in the Galapagos, deeper waters are brought to the surface, and those deeper waters are older. You know, they've been basically accumulating particulate organic matter that's been raining down from the surface over decades to hundreds of years sometimes. And that organic matter, when it settles in the deep ocean, it gets respired by microbes, and they release CO2, and it creates these low pH waters. So the Galapagos represents a real-world natural climate lab, essentially, because it's been hit by this extreme heat stress, but it also provides us a natural laboratory for what the rest of the world's going to look like as the oceans continue to absorb carbon dioxide and their pH decline. So as the oceans continue to have the pH decline, basically that makes reefs more vulnerable to erosion, in particular bioerosion. So there's a wide diversity of organisms on coral reefs that, you know, actively bore into coral skeletons. So you can think of it almost like termites on land, you know. So when you walk in a forest and you see a dead tree, you know, there's fungi growing on it. There might be some termites and beetles boring into it. So it's a very similar analogy on a coral reef. When a coral dies, it starts getting bioeroded by a bunch of different organisms. Well, that bioerosion is stimulated at low pH conditions. So you had a perfect storm in the Galapagos of extremely high heat that basically killed off all the corals. And then that reef was completely eroded away because the environment, the seawater chemistry, is essentially corrosive to the persistence of coral reefs. Now, there is one reef that is still exists in the Galapagos Islands today, and that is in the very, very far northern island of Darwin. And that reef has been appropriately named after Jerry Wellington. It's called Wellington Reef. And that reef is built by essentially one species of coral, and it's the most stress-tolerant coral you could basically find in the world's oceans. Now, this coral can be found from the coast of Ecuador all the way to the coast of Kenya. So it's very well mixed. It's very stress tolerant. And that is the only coral left building reefs in the Galapagos. And it's only at one site. And that one site where there's still a coral reef, that has the most favorable seawater chemistry for reef development. So it has the highest pH. So this suggests, you know, a causal link between the acidification of the world's oceans and the ability of coral reefs to rebound from these thermal stress events. Again, the Galapagos is a worst-case scenario. It essentially gives us a recipe for how to completely wipe coral reefs off the planet, right? And that's 2 to 3 degrees Celsius of warming plus about 2 to 3 times, you know, pre-industrial levels of atmospheric CO2. And that will basically eliminate coral reef ecosystems for planet Earth.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Derek Manzello, coordinator for NOAA's Coral Reef Watch program. And we are asking, will coral survive global warming? Derek, talk to us about attempts at assisted evolution to save corals. What is being done and how is it going?
Assisted evolution is the idea that we, as humans, via interventions, can hopefully jumpstart the adaptation of corals to higher temperatures. And this involves many different types of active research. Now, in the most general sense, scientists will try to identify certain coral individuals or certain coral species that are more able to withstand high temperatures. Within a certain species of coral, you know, there are different individuals, just like there are different individuals of humans, right? So some of us, well, not very many of us, but some of us are really, really good athletes, right? But that is a statistical rarity in essence. So not everyone is Usain Bolt, right? Most of us kind of fall in the middle of that bell curve, you know, we're not really that good at athletically, you know, we're okay, whatever. But, you know, there are always these anomalies. So coral scientists are essentially looking for the Usain Bolt of coral individuals. And what I mean is they want the super corals that are, for whatever reason, exhibit these really anomalously high fitness output, high performance output. And the idea is to understand what is it about those corals that allows them to resist high temperatures so much better when other coral species can just die very, very rapidly. So we saw in Florida Keys last year, it got so hot so fast that certain species of coral, in particular the Elkhorn corals, they didn't even bleach. Their tissue just sloughed off because it got so hot so fast they experienced acute heat shock. So the question is, why do those corals just lose their tissue and why are other corals able to survive? So the idea is to identify these super corals and then figure out genetically how are they surviving this? You know, what genes are being expressed? What is it about their symbiosis? And then taking that information and trying to breed those genes or whatever is causing that heat tolerance into a new generation of corals. So there are some fantastic, really, really exciting, you know, research coming out of this that shows that, yes, we can pass on heat tolerance to a next generation of corals. The issue is the magnitude of climate change and the rate of warming of the oceans is just, it's grossly outpacing the ability of, you know, the very modest amounts of science that's going in to try to do this assisted evolution process. So coral scientists, it's really a David and Goliath thing, right? You're facing this global scale threat that is just rapidly increasing. And now we're seeing, you know, as we said earlier, temperatures are off the charts, higher than they've ever been before. So, you know, this threat is getting worse than anybody anticipated over a year ago. So there are some very exciting results coming out of assisted evolution, and it's likely that it will find some success for some coral species in certain locations. Unfortunately, what humans can do on a coral reef is going to be very, very localized in spatial scale. So we have to remember, you know, the Great Barrier Reef's bigger than the country of Italy. So it's not feasible to talk about restoring the entirety of the Great Barrier Reef. So it really comes down to triaging resources and effort to specific areas. So, you know, it's likely that scientists are going to be able to maintain and keep certain reef areas doing okay and hanging on. But, you know, in the large scale, big picture issue, you know, the research that's happening right now is really just, you know, at a severe disadvantage and is really unable to keep up just because the resources and the effort and the personnel going into that is just, it can't keep pace with the impacts we're seeing in nature.
Do you and your co-authors have predictions for coral bleaching in 2024?
So, unfortunately, the wider Caribbean Sea and Florida are already hotter now than they were last year. So, as of May 27th, the sea surface temperatures have exceeded the bleaching threshold in the Florida Keys. Now, this is a full 3 weeks to 4 weeks earlier than what happened last year. And that is highly significant and highly unprecedented. And again, that word unprecedented gets thrown around way too much, but this is highly unprecedented. And the reason I say that is because I have been, you know, tracking coral bleaching events in Florida now for over 20 years. And up until, I would say, 2018, I wouldn't even think about coral bleaching until August. And the reason I say that is because historically bleaching events would always happen late August, early September. So when I was doing my research in Florida, when August would roll around, you know, it would become the dog days of summer. And I would say, okay, let me look at the sea temperatures in Florida, see what's going on. Are we at risk of a bleaching event this year? Well, last year, everything changed. So bleaching started in early July last year, and temperatures skyrocketed to record levels in early July. So last year, we saw bleaching start a full 5 to 6 weeks earlier than had ever happened before, which meant the bleaching event lasted longer than ever before, and the heat stress was 2 to 3 times higher than had ever been experienced before. So the fact that in 2024, we're now seeing these patterns play out, and they're playing out again at you know, much earlier than happened last year, is incredibly alarming. So we're already seeing bleaching-level heat stress in the Southern Caribbean, in, you know, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Colombia, and it's starting to develop in places like the Virgin Islands and Mexico and Belize. And as I said, the bleaching threshold has got breached in the last few days in Florida. So this is a very, very alarming situation we're dealing with here, because we are marching right back into what looks like another historically unprecedented bleaching event. And this is very, very scary because, you know, in a lot of places last year, we've heard, again, it's going to take some time to fully document the impacts from what happened last year. And the main reason for that is because, you know, corals can die upwards of 1 to 2 years after a bleaching event from disease. So we're still kind of counting what happened last year, right? And now we're facing this another bleaching event that could potentially be worse. And the reason that's so concerning is because we've heard reports in certain locations that there was 90 to 100% mortality of elkhorn and staghorn corals in certain locations. And that is incredibly alarming because elkhorn coral in particular has been the dominant reef builder in the wider Caribbean for the last 500,000 years. So, you know, you think back in time, elkhorn coral has been building reefs now for 500,000 years in the Caribbean. And then last year, we saw essentially local extinctions from certain locations. And now the fact that we're seeing such high levels of heat stress develop again, I mean, we really need to be on extinction watch this year, to be totally honest, because if we do see a bleaching event play out again in the Caribbean, and it seems like it's going to be worse than last year, you know, this, like I said, existential threat, I mean, that is the word of summer for the Caribbean, unless things start changing and changing rapidly. So essentially, you know, since February 2023, the majority of the world's coral reefs have experienced bleaching level heat stress, and we've seen mass bleaching all over the world. So northern, southern hemisphere of both the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Oceans. There are a few locations, though, that have, for whatever reason, been spared. So, in particular, Hawaii has not really seen any heat stress last year, and right now it's still kind of not seeing any heat stress, and also Western Australia. But, you know, aside from those locations, pretty much every reef region on the planet has experienced thermally stressful conditions within the last year. And this is very scary, again, because, like I said, we saw such severe impacts last year, and now we're even hotter now than we were last year. And we're talking about the potential for bleaching to start a full 2 to 3 months earlier than it normally has historically started in places like Florida. So, again, it's unprecedented. I'm getting sick and tired of using that word, but this is unprecedented. And again, it looks like we're marching right back into another really, really bad bleaching year for the North Atlantic reef regions.
Yeah, I worry that anybody born after the year 2000 could be the last generation able to see the multicolored splendor of the reefs. I can't imagine a world without coral. Can you? What happens then?
So, yeah, I mean, nobody wants to imagine that. You know, that would be just horrible. You know, I have young kids, and last year when Florida was going through its worst bleaching event on record, you know, it made me a little emotional because I've always had plans. You know, I knew which reef I was going to take my kids to first when they were old enough to go snorkeling. And, you know, I don't know if that reef's going to be there anymore by the time they're old enough for me to teach them how to scuba dive. The climate projections predict pretty much every coral reef on planet Earth is going to experience annual severe bleaching every year, sometime between 2040 and 2050. The big concern there is it takes corals years to basically recover from one bleaching event. If they're getting hit with bad bleaching, bad thermal stress events every year, they're never going to be able to recover. They're going to be in a state of chronic stress. Presumably, that will lead to essentially attrition, right? Just continued loss and loss and loss of corals until we're basically only left with kind of the cockroach corals of the sea, right? Again, coral reefs of the future, the worst-case scenario would be that we do lose a large fraction of our living corals. We do potentially lose some species to extinction. But, you know, if there's any nugget of hope, it's that as long as that three-dimensional reef structure is maintained, then a decent amount of the biodiversity that lives on coral reefs can persist for some time. But again, much of the biodiversity on a coral reef is associating with that architecturally complex three-dimensional structures. Once you have mass mortality of living coral, you start losing that three-dimensional structure. So the reef starts flattening out, and then you start actually, you know, physically losing that reef structure itself. So about 70% of Florida's coral reef was net erosional before last year's bleaching event. And those results have been confirmed by, you know, three independent studies, one by NOAA, two by the U.S. Geological Survey. So once you start losing that three-dimensional structure of a reef, that is when you really start talking about kind of these catastrophic losses, the losses of biodiversity. And, you know, the other thing people don't realize is, you know, we're always kind of thinking like, oh, you know, aesthetically, the thought of losing corals is horrible. But, you know, coral reefs are providing dollars to the U.S. economy, right, and also the global economy. So it's estimated that reefs are providing more than $3 billion a year to the U.S. economy, and that number is in the trillions globally. And some of the stuff that's contributing economically is things we don't even realize. So reefs are very important for coastal protection from storms. So healthy reefs can attenuate, I think, like 97% of the wave energy that a coast would experience during an event like a hurricane or a cyclone or a typhoon. So once those corals die and that reef becomes flattened and eroded, they're much less able to dampen that wave energy. So as coral reefs degrade, we're going to see more and more impacts from things like storms. And also, we have to remember, too, that sea level rise is taking place. So not only are the reefs becoming flattening and basically eroding, the ocean above them is getting deeper, essentially, right? So that's a compounding impact on those potentially devastating impact to coastal communities. So places like the Florida Keys, you know, in Hawaii, you know, as the corals die and they become degraded, we're going to see more and more basically impacts to humans. And as you're probably aware, you know, getting homeowners insurance in a place like Florida now is unbelievably expensive. So this problem is only going to get worse, unfortunately. And, you know, again, I keep telling everyone, we don't know what's going to happen. I have my fingers crossed that we're going to see some unexpected adaptation in certain corals. But, you know, as of right now, the prognosis is quite poor, unfortunately. This problem is not going to go away until the international community gets together and comes up with a solution to break our dependence on fossil fuels, right? Anything that can be done until that happens is just going to be a Band-Aid on a severed artery, essentially, and only really help stop the bleeding in certain very localized, limited locations.
Well, unfortunately, like the corals, we've run out of time for this interview. We have been speaking with Dr. Derek Manzello, coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch program. He's co-author of the paper Coral Reefs in Peril in a Record-Breaking Year. Find links to that and my notes and more to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Derek, thank you so much for taking time to speak with our listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If space aliens examined this fossil-powered civilization, would they see a single organism? Are we something that consumes our home planet, converting it to dead waste? Can we change that? Dr. Eric Pinault is a professor in the Department of Sociology and the Institute of Environmental Sciences at the Université du Québec à Montréal. Over many years, Pinault compiled his book, The Social Ecology of Capital, published in 2023. It examines the metabolism of our current age. From Montreal, Canada, Eric Pinault, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
A well-informed listener recommended your book, which he connected to the degrowth movement. But actually, although you make a case of why growth continues almost forever under capitalism, that's degrowth is not really the theme of social ecology of capital, is it?
No, it isn't. It's something I take up at the end in the conclusion as kind of the political consequence of how I understand the materiality of current societies and their trajectory. But it's not a book about degrowth, even though I must say that it grew out of discussion with colleagues, mostly in Germany, in the German degrowth research community, but also colleagues in Barcelona.
Yes, we think of a metabolism as actions and reactions in an organism that sustain life. What do you mean by social metabolism?
Yeah, well, social metabolism is looking at society and trying to understand in an analog way, and I'll go further than the analogy in a few minutes, but in an analog way to a body or to a human being or to a cell, how societies must, to reproduce themselves in time, extract, transform, and then dissipate matter and energy. And this way of looking at societies is actually very old, and the first uses of the concept of metabolism in Germany in the 18th century, and beginning 19th by Liebig and others, they used the concept of metabolism not only to understand cells and human or animal bodies or plant bodies, but also to look at groups, cities, countries, societies. So it was a very plastic concept that then was narrowed down in the 19th century by biologists. And finally, since the, I'd say, mid-1980s, this more holistic understanding of metabolism has come back with people from what we call industrial ecology. So people that were looking back in the 60s and 70s and 80s at how our economy had to digest material. And basically that view was widened to the whole of society.
And just for orientation, what were some socio-metabolic systems before the emergence of fossil fuels?
We have, in the community that works on this, this is the community that we call ourselves social ecologists because we're interested in the ecological relations of societies. And we say there are two basic forms of relations. Societies have a metabolic relation, so they extract, absorb, transform, digest, and dissipate materials and energies. And societies also colonize ecosystems. They transform them. They cultivate them. They change. They can mineralize them, actually, also. So looking at with these two tools, social ecologists will distinguish three large, and this is not surprising as a way to look at history, but three large metabolic regimes, we call them, three ways of relating metabolically to nature, of extracting, transforming, and dissipating. Hunter-gatherers are one way of relating to ecosystems, and basically you're acting inside the ecosystem's relations as it is. You are affecting them like other animals and plants are affecting ecosystem relations, you are socializing, in a sense, the ecosystem, but you're still acting as a predator or as in the trophic chain. So you're basically taking biomass as it exists and using it. The second regime, which is the one in which what we call human civilizations arose, so literature, state, organized forms, political life, city life, urbanization, all this is tied to what we call the agrarian metabolic regime, which is tied to the Neolithic period and goes all the way up to the 19th century. And even today, there are still societies that are still relating in a predominantly agrarian way to ecosystems. And that's basically societies that depend on agricultural productivity for their material relations. And then finally, starting in the mid-19th century and then really coming together in the 20th century and still stuck in that today, and that's a problem for us, are the fossil-based societies. And we call it fossil industrial regime because industry tends to displace agriculture as the prominent relation to ecosystems, even further, agriculture is industrialized in a sense. So that's the way we cut out periods in history.
Until the modern industrial era, humans operated at the surface. And one of the things that really struck me reading your book and looking at your charts is that now the majority of our energy and materials come from below. We've become a kind of species almost like worms or moles that feeds on the underground.
Yeah, that was an observation that I took from an Austrian historian called Zifferle, Rolf Zifferle, who wrote a brilliant book called The Subterranean Forest. And his argument, which I take into my book, is that what happens in Great Britain during the Industrial Revolution is basically that economy, that capitalist economy, is able to grow because it taps into energy that is below the surface of the earth. And if Great Britain had tried to pull off the Industrial Revolution only with its surface biomass, which means, you know, what can we grow in our forests and fields? It would have been impossible. Growth would have stopped rather rapidly. So it was access to this pre-existing stock of biomass that was fossilized that permitted the Industrial Revolution to take off. And then from then on, we can say that that's our first takeoff phase where we become as capitalist societies, dependent on pre-existing organized matter that is under the earth. And then we turn to metals, and then we turn to stone, sand, limestone and sand, bringing them together to make cement. And basically, we reconfigure our material relations from surface relations where we would depend on animal skins for our clothing or for our some tools. We would depend on wood. We would depend on what we can get from fields for ropes, for food, or what we can build houses or buildings out of would come from the surface, from ecological cycles. We would massively turn towards these geological materials. Now that's not to say that earlier in human history, we did not use these materials. We did look at the pyramids, but the scale of, you know, you calculate the amount of mass of a pyramid, and then you just look at a small town in the U.S., and you've got much more material of geological origin in these small towns. Let's say the one here that I live by, which is called Cowansville, you probably have about 10 pyramids in a small town. So it's really this reconfiguration of relations to the earth. And, you know, even though the concept of Anthropocene, which you might have talked about in the past, is being debated by geologists, we could say that we are or geological dependent species now in the 21st century.
And what is a metabolic rift, and does that apply to our current predicament?
Okay, so the metabolic rift. It's not actually a concept that I tend to use a lot in my work. It's a concept that comes from Marx, actually, and even before Marx, from Liebig. Now, Liebig is this German chemist who was interested in soil. He's considered one of the founders of soil science. He's the one that identifies these three critical minerals for plant growth, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So we owe to him this understanding of the role of mineral elements in plant growth. And it was Liebig that talked about a metabolic rift when he said, well, we grow things in the countryside. And in the past, these things we would grow in the countryside would nourish the peasants, feed the peasants and their animals. And their animals and the peasants would then return this biomass back to the fields in the form of, well, manure, human manure or animal manure. And then we had a full cycle. So we had a metabolic cycle that worked, that was in balance. And Liebig says, with the advent of urbanization and of what we would call capitalist agriculture, so large-scale extractive agriculture, what we're doing is we're taking all this biomass out of the fields with the minerals in it, we're bringing it into the cities, concentrating it there, and then we're dissipating it in the cities, and usually that meant sending it into a river, into a bay, or into a lake or some water body. And the rift is at both ends of this linear process. So we had a circular process that was in equilibrium with nature. And this linear process, then the linearization of this process, implies a rift at both ends of the line. At the one end, you're depleting your soils because organic matter and critical minerals are not coming back into the fields. And at the other end, you're overcharging ecosystems, marine, river, or lake ecosystems, which have to absorb all this extra biomass supercharged with these critical minerals for living beings, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And then you'll get algal blooms, and you'll get basically what we would call today pollution. So Liebig is the first to look at this, and then Marx takes this concept and widens it and says this is something that is specific to capitalist agriculture in general. It is depleting on the one hand, and it is overcharging on the other hand. And this concept was then used, I think it really started to take off in the 70s and 80s, as political economists that would refer to Marx would look at the environmental crisis as one where these circular equilibrium-type relations are being replaced by linearized relations.
Talk to us about the late Murray Bookchin and his influence on your work.
Murray was a defining influence on me as a person, actually. I met Murray when I was, I think, around 19 years old. I went to study in Vermont, in Plainfield, Vermont, at the Institute of Social Ecology, where Bookchin taught. And I spent the summer there learning, and then we developed a very close relation. He was kind of my mentor. I was not a student at that point in my life. I was working, and it was before I entered university, but I was old enough to be in university. So Bookchin kind of replaced for 4 or 5 years what college does to kids when you're 20, 21, 22. So he had a really important impact on me. He really informed the way I understood society-nature relations and made me a radical environmentalist back in the early 90s, actually, and still to today. I mean, all my ecological activism really goes back to Bookchin. I started the book thinking a lot about Bookchin because Bookchin's philosophy is called social ecology. His theory is called social ecology. But actually, I had encountered another version of social ecology about 10 years ago when I was working on tar sands extraction in Canada and how to understand pipelines and things like that. I'm a political economist by training, and I needed something that could help me grasp the materiality of our society, of our economic relations. And I was looking around inside the field of ecological economics, and I stumbled upon this school of social ecology in Vienna, who are the ones that developed this metabolic understanding of economic relations. So I kind of adopted their approach. It seemed to me very fitting, very useful for critical analysis of fossil-based societies and fossil-based corporations, very analytically rigorous and well empirically grounded also. That's the thing I like about social ecology a la Vienna. It's very grounded empirically and measures, you know, quantifies actually the metabolic relations we have in a very rigorous way. So then I had to reconcile that social ecology with Murray's social ecology. And the one thing that I started reading once again, Ecology of Freedom, Philosophy of Social Ecology, and reading these works, well, first I realized how much he had an influence on me. But then also some passages or some ways of understanding the social nature relations sounded to me, or I read them as problematic from my point of view. Murray basically had an approach which was both analytical and normative. He was looking at ecology as a science to find some normative principles that then we could apply to societies. So, and he was using the ecology of his day, so the ecological sciences in the 70s. And then he found these principles like unity and diversity, complementarity, non-hierarchical relations, the importance of cooperation or symbiosis, we would say today, in ecological relations. And he said, well, if we look at these relations in nature, they are the ones that create a stable, flourishing ecosystem. So then, if we want stable, flourishing societies, we should mimic might not be the right term, but we should organize our social relations and our institutions around these founding principles. And for me, that was problematic because, well, first of all, ecological science has moved beyond the 70s. Some of these ideas have been conserved. Others have been subsumed by other ideas. That's one thing. And then as a sociologist, I had issues with the idea that we should transpose normative principles from nature to society. The second thing that I found problematic in Bookchin was his theory of history. And it's very subtle, and it actually, the problem I found was subtle because it's kind of a contradictory aspect of his argument. But one could find some form of evolutionism inside his worldview, where he said basically life the living planet has moved from simplicity to complexity and from very low degrees of reflexivity towards higher degrees of reflexivity and from low degrees of autonomy to high degrees of autonomy. And so this progressive or progressivist understanding of natural history, which then fuses with social history, for me was a problem. And I remember Murray would always tell me, Eric, don't read Stephen Jay Gould. It's total crap and it's not, it doesn't work. And I read Stephen Jay Gould and I really understood why Murray didn't like Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould basically considers evolutionary history as contingent. There are no transhistorical laws to the evolution of life on this planet. Life strives, flourishes, and collapses, and it's done so five times before the sixth time that we've forced nature into, which is the sixth extinction. But there's been five extinctions before the one that we've started, and so one cannot have this very linear understanding of nature, which again had a normative objective for Murray. So those are the two ideas that I basically had problems with. But the rest, you know, the importance of ecological relations for social relations, the autonomy, but the dialectical relation between nature and society in these relations, and the fact that the ecological crisis is grounded in social relations. That was the great argument that Murray made, and that is still today for me a fundamental idea.
So we've got many, many problems due to the growth of humanity and our impact on the planet. And when this is pointed out, business and politicians and labor and media all suggest that we need more growth in order to handle that. What is going on? Why is growth always the answer?
The growth is an answer because we are growth-based societies. And that's something that I discussed at the very end of the book, but I would say that, you know, my colleagues, especially Jason Hickel or people like Yorgos Kallis or people like Matthias Schmelzer have written a lot about this, or Anitra Nelson have written a lot about these ideas. And it's something that we can trace back to Schneeberg, actually, an American sociologist writing in the 70s and 80s. And he talks about growth coalitions. He says modern advanced capitalist societies are growth dependent. Though they have divisions, though there are struggles between labor and capital, for example, or between the state and labor, or between the state and capital, these are the three great forces of capitalist societies, three great macroeconomic agents of a society, labor, capital, and the state. So these three large agents, they struggle against each other. You know, they have their different material interests. But they all together have an interest in growth. They are all growth dependent. And actually, when they have growth, their conflicts tend to be mitigated by growth. So these distribution conflicts around who gets, you know, the share of output, of value added, of what comes out of our economy in the form of productivity or the surplus, we could call it. It's a concept that I use a lot in my book. This surplus, as it grows, then we're not the social conflict around the appropriation of the surplus is mitigated. Whereas if growth stalls, then the struggle becomes very, very existential for these agents, and societies tend to be riven by conflict. So this growth coalition, when faced with a crisis, will tend to look at growth as the solution, even if growth is the origin of the crisis. So that's an argument that, you know, that I make, but I think it's an argument, you know, going back to Schneeberg, an argument made by my degrowth colleagues. What I add maybe to this argument is more specific to capitalist economies. And I say that it's that when capitalist growth meets a limit, meets some form of resistance to its development, it will tend to accumulate more capacity at that point of resistance. And I'll give a real example in 2 seconds to overcome that specific limit. And a great example is oil. As we depleted our sources of conventional oil in the last 30 years, we're discovering less and less exploitable sources of conventional oil. You know, the old method where you would just basically stick a pipe in the ground and watch the black stuff gush out because you had access to these huge reserves under pressure. So as we run out of that, well, what we've done is we've accumulated capital exactly at that frontier. The limit to extraction, and that took two forms. We've developed technologies around fracking, which gives us access to unconventional sources of oil in different forms of geological reservoirs that we knew exist. You know, we haven't discovered recently their existence. We knew this oil was there. We call it tide oil. We've known about this for almost 75 years. And then the other technology that we've developed is CCUS, where we go into these old reservoirs and we pump back CO2 or other gases or liquids, but mostly CO2, and we extract, we wring out the last drops of oil from those reserves. So that's, again, how growth is the answer to the crisis of growth.
Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Eric Pignol from Montreal, and we're talking about social ecology. Now, Karl Marx, starting in the 1840s in Germany until he was expelled as a radical, he set out to capture the enigma of capitalism. What is it? And he analyzed world trade and in great detail, one of the first real big picture operations of his time. You gathered an impressive catalog of charts and graphs not easily found in one place, so things like global material flows 1970 to 2017 and global primary energy consumption by source 1800 to 2020. Great stuff to find. Why did you go into those details?
Well, I needed to have a sound foundation to understand the material nature of our economy. I wanted to move away from impressionistic uses of the term of growth or accumulation. And I wanted to be confronted with the numbers. I think that there's something very important in being confronted with numbers because you then discover things that you wouldn't have discovered otherwise. So first of all, that the biggest part of our material footprint is actually not oil and it's not metals. It's basically cement. It's concrete. That's our biggest material footprint. And I wanted to confront the numbers, to have a picture, a representation of this materiality of the world economy, of the what I call in my book the throughput. So the throughput is the amount of matter and energy that is extracted and dissipated by society, of the way it's distributed among societies around unequal relations between north and south and even inside societies. For me, that was an important aspect, to have this sound quantitative base of my analysis. I also made the gamble that today that tends to be the way societies understand themselves. So it's a language. For me, I talk about it at the beginning of the book as a language. It's a language that societies have developed because that materiality is today part of the problems that they have. Our environmental accounts have matured in the last 10 years, and I just happened to appear at the same time. And actually, since I've written the book, we now have up-to-date accounts for material flows to the year 2023 and even estimations for 2024 or 180 countries. So actually, I'm updating these numbers, and maybe I can throw one in just to give an idea of what it looks like when you work with this type of material. The amount of matter we extract globally is today, 2023, around 102, 101 gigatons of matter. And the estimations for 224 are 104 gigatons. When I wrote my book, we were actually 94 gigatons, I think I have in the book. So the growth rate is incredible. It's doubled since the 70s, this material extraction. And to put that number into perspective, if you look at the amount of biomass that nature produces in a year, everything that results from photosynthesis, what the trees are able to extract from the sun or what the grasses are able to extract from the sun, which is basically the basic of all living relations on Earth, well, that represents about 100 to 110, depending on how we count it, gigatons of matter. So today, human societies are extracting from the Earth as much matter as nature, what we call nature, which is living nature, produces in a year. It's also very disturbing.
Yes, it is. And for example, you note that in 2015, the total flow coming from food production was less than the total flow just coming from mine tailings. Now, that's pretty revealing about the kind of species that we've become. But that only works until the point of breakdown. Does your book include possibilities of collapse?
Actually, at the end of the book, I do talk about this question of radical transformation either being a willful radical transformation or a imposed radical transformation from natural processes that would just go haywire. I don't directly discuss this question in the book. I have worked on it in other writings, in more scholarly writings, like a paper that I wrote with 30 other authors on planetary boundaries from a social science perspective or political economy perspective. So it's not something I take up in the book, but it's something I've discussed elsewhere. And the idea is that the way things could break down as we hit boundaries, of course, there are boundaries. So capital can transform boundaries into springboards. That's something that we observe through history. But this history we're observing is rare, from a Earth science perspective, is rather short. We're talking about 250 years, maybe, in terms of Earth science, or even in terms of material history of humanity, very short. You do have periods of what we would call today growth, of expansion, material expansion, but then you also have collapses, which are caused by climate-related events or caused by metabolic problems, like saturating soils with salt because you're over-irrigating crops, which happened in Sumer and happened many times in Mesopotamia. So then if you look back at our society today, then what is the time scale in which we're analyzing this problem? If we're looking at it in our lifetime, maybe we won't see collapse. We will see radical environmental change, and this will be very challenging for our societies. But maybe if we look at a more from a more secular point of view and go back and count in millennia, then, of course, our society will hit irreversible environmental change. And I'm a firm believer that this irreversible environmental change, nonlinear ecological processes that the Earth system science looks at, for example, collapse of, let's say, the Gulf Stream. That would be one radical collapse of the ice sheets. A total transformation of phosphorus and nitrogen cycles. We've taken them over because of our industrial agriculture. These types of things, which would bring around nonlinear change, which we would understand as human beings as collapse situations.
So, Andy, your last chapter is called Emancipation Amid the Ruins of Fossil Metabolism, and that says a lot about where we are. Eric, what are you working on next?
Usually when you look at economy, we look at an economy through the lens of two relations, production and consumption. And in my book, I argue that we should actually have a four-tier approach to economic relations, at least from a metabolic point of view. So we should look at extraction, production, consumption, and dissipation. And for me, extraction and dissipation are frontiers in the sense that they are system borders where nature and society interact around this frontier. And I'm working the working title is Accumulation Frontiers. I'm trying to understand how capitalism develops at the frontier, how it accumulation at the point of extraction and accumulation at the point of dissipation are important to understand the materiality of societies and also sources of ecological and environmental struggles and crises.
From the University of Quebec in Canada, we have been speaking with Professor Eric Pignot. He is the author of the big picture book, The Social Ecology of Capital, And this book gave my brain a hard workout, I will tell you. You can find links and more notes in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks a lot for having me. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.